a rocket that can land back on its tail on its original launch pad. I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Earl Renaud, Chief Operating Officer for TGV Rockets Incorporated. We're going to find out more about this company today, and especially more about a noteworthy recent achievement. Earl, thanks for taking a few minutes out to spend with our listeners. Where are you today?
Right now, I'm in Mississippi, down at NASA's Stennis Space Center.
All right, and tell us what's going on there today.
Well, today we're taking apart hardware and inspecting it and going to go around and put it back on the stand again.
Okay, now you guys have developed, and we'll talk about who you guys are in a moment, but you guys have developed what you call a technologically advanced throttleable rocket engine that you believe will one day be able to facilitate the shuttling of equipment and sensor payloads on quick turnaround suborbital missions for the military. Now, if I close my eyes and really think about what that could mean, that's a pretty big field. First, start off by telling us why the quick turnaround part is important to the military.
It all goes back to being able to do lightweight operations. The more people have to touch a piece of hardware and the more work they have to do on it, your operational cost goes up, your operational flexibility goes down, and the utility of your system goes down. One of the things that the military works very hard at with fighter aircraft is sortie rate, being able to turn around a vehicle very rapidly with a minimum crew and get it back into the fight. And we're a defense contractor, so primarily that's our concern too, being able to maintain a very high utilization rate of the system.
All right.
But that's one of those things that ties into commercial space as well. And one of the reasons space flight costs so much is because of the immense amount of labor it takes to ready a vehicle for flight, or if it's a reusable like the shuttle, to refurbish it after a flight and get it ready for the next one.
Well, and we watch that with agony every time they go to launch another shuttle flight. They're going to try real hard to get four in this year. And, you know, when you look at what it takes to get the shuttle ready, we read press releases from NASA for weeks and weeks about how this step has been completed and how this will be put on the crawler to roll to the launch pad, you know, a couple weeks ahead of time. And, you know, a day early, the fuel will be unloaded and that sort of thing. What about your technology will facilitate a fast turnaround?
We've worked very hard to nail that turnaround and the operability in a number of different technology areas. Our vehicle concept was originally based on the McDonnell Douglas Delta Clipper, the DCX. And it turned out that when they flew their vehicle, one of their main operational difficulties was in heat shield refurbishment. So to take that as an example, we worked very hard at developing a thermal protection system that required as little maintenance as possible, you know, ideally none between flight. And if it did require any maintenance, it was something that, similar to a line replaceable unit in an aircraft, you could take a couple bolts off, pull a piece out, pop a new one on, and go, you know, so that you optimize that utility as much as possible.
Okay, tell us about the throttleable rocket engine. What this appears to do is open up the possibility of vehicles that can go into suborbital or orbital space and then return to Earth and land tail first, like we all saw on the rockets that were envisioned by the cartoonists in the 60s, and have that controllable rocket, controllable thrust that would let them come and land back on their tail again on the Earth. Is that what we're looking at?
Yep. If you want to basically hover a rocket, which is what you're talking about when you're landing, your thrust has to be equal to your weight. It has to have a thrust range that's equivalent to the weight range of the vehicle. And a large space launch vehicle, when it takes off, can be 80 or even 90% fuel. So if you take off at 100% thrust, when you come back to land, the vehicle only weighs 10% of what it did at takeoff. So your engine has to be able to efficiently throttle down to that 10% thrust level, or you need to make your vehicle more complicated and have different size engines or be able to shut some off and turn some on. But even then, you get into trying to handle abort situations where you might have to land with a mid-size amount of weight. And if you actually go through all the engineering, it's very difficult to do without a deep throttling engine.
Well, I know that one of the other private space companies that's been in the news lately has a rocket which they send into suborbital flight, and it returns using, you know, a free fall and a parachute, and then they have to kind of go find it afterwards. You're talking about being able to come back theoretically to the same pad or to a very predictable location, as opposed to having any kind of recovery costs.
Right where you take off is right where you land, so that you have to do no moving of the vehicle between flights. It's basically come out, do some inspection, do what service you have to, refuel, and go again.
Tell us about a rocket that uses JP-8 fuel. I'm trying to imagine how this works. You must have to combine. JP-8 won't burn in a vacuum. Do you combine liquid oxygen with this, or how is that?
Yes, it's JP-8 and liquid oxygen, or the propellant and the oxidizer combo. We specifically targeted JP-8 because developing a vehicle for military use, we were looking for a fuel that is readily accessible everywhere in the world in the military inventory. You know, on any Army base in U.S. Army base in the world, you can call up the supply guy and get a truck of JP-8. It's very hard to call up a guy and get a truck of RP-1, rocket propellant.
Right.
And hydrogen's even harder.
Mm-hmm.
So we were looking, again, it goes back to that operational simplicity goal. We were looking for something that would give us, in military terms, the minimum logistical tail, the minimum amount of new stuff that you have to put in place dedicated to operating this system as opposed to using things that are already in the inventory.
All right, you guys have been around for 10 years as a company. Tell us, you know, a little bit about the timeline that led up to your successful test firings, which are fairly recently.
Well, the first, I'd say 6 years or 5 years of that, we're all working 9 to 5, which meant 9 at night to 5 in the morning, because we all had day jobs.
Right, right.
We didn't receive our first contract until 2003. So we've actually only been really working on this project for 4 years.
Okay.
We went down several different paths with engines. We went to one of the major engine development contractors, you know, one of the large aerospace firms, and paid them a substantial amount of money to do a preliminary design. And when that study was done, you know, we went to the next phase. They decided that they were no longer interested, which was okay for us because the cost estimate was $90 million in 8 years to do the job. So we weren't that interested either. Then we went to another engine vendor, and they were very interested, but their technical solution left a lot to be desired. They wanted to reuse a piece of hardware that they already had, and we had serious technical concerns about whether or not it would work. So we began to look at other alternatives. And the second vendor that we had talked to wanted $15 million just to modify an existing system.
Mm.
And I actually ran into a former astronaut, T.K. Mattingly, the Navy admiral, at a meeting. And Admiral Mattingly suggested that when he was with Rocket Development Company, they built a hydrogen-fueled engine for $2 million. And he said, you know, here are the guys you should get. And he gave me a list of names.
Right.
And he said, go find these guys and hire them and have them build it. And you could probably do it for about the same.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, well, you know, I should spend $2 million of my own money trying it this way before I should spend $15 million to have somebody else give me something that might or might not work.
Right, right.
And if we fail utterly, I can always go back to them. You know, and pay them their $15 million.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've wasted two, but out of 15, that's not a big deal. Yeah, the payoff there is huge. You know, so we decided to try it ourselves, and we initiated this program. Well, we first started talking to people about it 2 years ago, but it really got off the ground last summer.
Well, we'll be back in a moment to clarify exactly what off the ground means in this context. I'm Paul Plack, and you're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
Diamond's DA-42 Twin Star is General Aviation's ultimate flying machine. Fly fast with the confidence of a twin for the cost of a single. Go direct over water or rugged terrain and cover great distances in the first and only piston aircraft with an advanced airframe, avionics, and engines. The DA-42 gives you options you've never had before, including the Garmin G1000 and no ice protection. Go where you want, when you want, fast and for less. Visit Diamond on the web at www.diamondair.com or call 888 888-
888-359-3220.
Finally, aviation headsets have evolved. Clarity Aloft is the next generation of headset design for a number of reasons. Clarity Aloft headsets are known for the superior clarity of sound. They're lightweight but rugged enough to meet military specifications. Best of all, they boast better noise reduction than ANR in the speech frequencies that matter most to you. For more information, call 612-747-3197 or check out the innovative Clarity Aloft headset on the web at clarityaloft.com.
Welcome back to this Aero News special feature. I'm Paul Flack, talking today with Earl Renault, who is the COO of TGV Rockets. And Earl, we've talked about the company. Let's talk specifically about the rocket. It's called the Michelle B vehicle, but Michelle is spelled with periods as if it's an acronym. What does this mean?
I hope I get this right. It's the Modular Incremental High Energy Launch Example.
Okay, there's one extra L in there somewhere, but...
Somewhere. I may have missed one.
Well, tell us a little
cost.
There
we go.
Okay. Tell us about the concept. This is a fairly well-rounded concept. This isn't just one-faceted idea. Tell us about, what this was setting out to do.
Well, we had started out, when Pat Bond, the CEO and founder, started the company, he had been working, doing lobbying work for the Delta Clipper. Keep the money flowing to that project. Mm-hmm. And that was a very similar vertical takeoff, vertical land rocket-powered vehicle that was run by a ballistic missile defense organization in the 90s. When that program was killed by President Clinton, Pat went back to McDonnell Douglas and said, do you mind if I pick up the pieces and try to go do it myself because I think it has commercial viability? And McDonnell Douglas said, we don't care what you do. Go knock yourself out. So we started to assemble the team and the ideas and track as much of the technology as we could and go out and try to find somebody else to fund the development of it. So really it has its whole genesis, both technically and programmatically, in that SDIO program, the Delta Clipper. And that's where we started with a vertical takeoff, vertical land, rocket-powered vehicle.
Okay, what kind of commercial potential does this vehicle seem to have? Who will use this?
Well, when we started out, we took a look at the Delta Clipper, and what Pat decided was that the vehicle, with very little modification, could service the existing sounding rocket market, which is, at the time, what they called expendable suborbital launch vehicle.
All right, let me stop you right here because tell our listeners, A, what a sounding rocket is, and B, who uses them.
A sounding rocket is a historical term from when they used to use rockets to do what they called soundings of the atmosphere. And then it became a term that was used for any rocket that was used to launch something high up into the atmosphere or out of the atmosphere, but that didn't go to orbit.
Okay.
So it basically just goes up on a ballistic trajectory and comes back down. Most of those flights are used for science experiments, either to measure something going very fast through the atmosphere or to do space physics or to do Earth or space observation work, looking up into space or looking down at the Earth from a high altitude, or testing sensors in a space environment.
Okay. Who buys this stuff, though?
Well, we did a fairly detailed market survey. And the market is kind of roughly divided between civilian science and military science and military R&D, military test work, like sensor development test. Mm-hmm. So it's about a third. And in, I think this was around 1998 dollars, it was about $200 million per segment of that segment.
Okay.
I may be a little high there, but... this was a few years ago, so my memory is a little rusty.
But it was over $500 million altogether.
Pretty close. And, so we looked at that size of market and said, if we're going to go after that size of a market, we can't really expect to go in there and take it all. But if we've got a solution that's better for the customer in terms of flexibility, better launch rates, lower cost, better ride environment, we should reasonably be able to get a 10% penetration. So that kind of gave us an idea of how much revenue we could earn from the vehicle in that market. And then working backwards, that tells you how much of an investment you can pay off, which bounds everything in terms of your technology and your development, because it puts an upper limit on how much you can spend.
Okay, now is this market going to be somewhat volatile based on the rise and fall of military spending for political or economic reasons?
You might think so, but when we looked back, it was remarkably steady over the past 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and despite, you know, upheavals in NASA and in military space and in civilian science, it's fairly, fairly steady work. There's not a lot of variation in it.
All right.
So we were comfortable going into this with the idea that we could get that.
All right, tell us about the vehicle itself and what makes it unique.
Well, there are a couple of different things. There are, right now, there is no operational, fully reusable launch vehicle out there. You know, about as, you know, you can talk about the shuttle, but even the shuttle throws away a big chunk of its hardware every time and almost destroys, you know, a couple others. The big solid rocket boosters take an immense amount of refurbishment, as well as the orbiter. So there aren't really any reusable vehicles out there to do space launch. So just that aspect alone would make the vehicle highly unique. Obviously, vertical takeoff and vertical landing is a flight mode that not too many people are addressing right now. Even in the emerging private launch industry, there are only two other people that are looking at vertical takeoff and vertical landing.
Well, that looks expensive on paper. I mean, if you're trying to go for the low end of the cost, if you're trying to undercut costs of competitors, you know, coming down in some way other than vertical looks like a more cost-effective way to go.
Operationally, what you want to avoid is taking off in a mode other than you land. You know, because then you have to do something to the vehicle to get it ready to take off again. So if you're going to take off vertically, you want to land vertically. If you want to take off horizontally, you want to land horizontally. You know, either taking off vertical and landing horizontal, or the opposite, taking off horizontal, landing vertical, means you've got to do some kind of a configuration change to the vehicle between flights. And that complicates operations. That's more ground crew, more equipment, everything else. So really, to optimize operations, you want to be vertical takeoff, vertical land, or horizontal takeoff, horizontal land.
Mm-hmm.
Out of the two, probably horizontal takeoff, horizontal land is operationally simpler because you've got landing gear and wheels, which you can use to roll your vehicle around.
Right.
However, for a launch vehicle that's going to point its nose up at some point in the flight path and go up, the majority of loading there is along the vertical axis, you know, along the center axis of the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're flying like an airplane, the loading axis is in the other direction. You know, it's perpendicular to the vehicle. You're hanging on wings.
Right.
So you've got to design a structure that can be loaded in two completely different directions. That is a much higher level of complexity than something that is always loaded down a central axis. So you end up with a heavier vehicle, a far more complicated vehicle, and when we looked at it, one that we couldn't realistically afford to build.
Okay, now your craft is designed to be remotely piloted. Tell us how that will work. I mean, I understand how things can be programmed with guidance systems, especially GPS probably makes that much simpler than it used to be when all you had was inertial guidance. But how will you remotely pilot this vehicle and land it? Is this going to take essentially video game skill sets?
Oh, no, no. It's, when you talk about remotely piloted, all of that means is that there is a man in the loop somewhere. And even and this is kind of philosophy, but even on a completely autonomous vehicle, there is a man in the decision loop somewhere. You know, somebody decides where that vehicle is going to go and what its mission is going to be. You know, so where you put the human decision maker in the control loop is kind of an arbitrary thing, and you can push them all the way down to the bottom where it's a person moving a stick that's connected with cables to something physical.
Mm-hmm.
Or they can be way up at the top where they're just going, you know, we should fly next Tuesday to, you know, Libya. So when we say remotely piloted, what we mean is that human decision maker, that operator, is remoted from the vehicle. He's not on board. But we're not talking about something where a guy's flying with a joystick. You know, our software is all based on the Delta Clipper software, and that had a completely autonomous or automatic flight mode.
Okay, let's assume we're short on time here, so let me get to how this will be used. Where do you see yourself in a couple of years, and if this launch vehicle is successful, Where will we hear it being launched from? What will be on it? Who will be using it?
Well, the path we're going down now is it's a military vehicle, so it would be the military using it, probably one of the major commands. The target market is for aerial surveillance, which in military terms is called ISR, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance.
Mm-hmm.
We go up and take pictures. So the way it would be used, it would have a very large optical package on the top. It flies up to 100 kilometers, takes a bunch of pictures of the bad guys, and brings them right back. So you'd see it operated in that mode, short duration photo reconnaissance, primarily into denied territory, which is where a long look from a high altitude is a big win. The other market that the military has expressed interest in is the ability to carry a very heavy, long-duration UAV and put it in place on very short notice. One of the problems with doing a very long-duration flight vehicle for reconnaissance, you know, like a super large UAV,
mm-hmm.
is it's very hard to launch it in any kind of weather. You know, if there's any ground wind, it's very tough to get, say, a parafoil-based system off the ground and then try to fly it up through all those different layers of weather up to 80,000 feet or 70,000 feet. If you have a vehicle that has a very heavy lift capacity that can launch in all weather, you can basically fly up to that, deploy one of these systems in place, and fly back down, and then that can go off and do its business. So there's a lot of interest in being able to do that kind of deployment mission as well.
Not to mention the fact that if you have a vehicle that's laden with enough fuel to have a long mission, a long endurance time, you don't want to necessarily burn the fuel it takes to get that heavy load up to the operating altitude. I know if you look at something like a Predator, you know, it's going to expend a significant portion of its fuel load just getting into operation. And if you can provide that part of it without, you know, tapping into that endurance, that sounds like a big deal too.
And that fuel fraction to climb is actually exponential with altitude.
Right.
So the higher you want to go, the more expensive it is.
Now, will this vehicle, I mean, could this be something that's carried around on trailers and launched from unprepared surfaces, so to speak?
I don't know if we'd want to launch on dirt, but we've actually looked at it and considered it. But absolutely, one of our high-level constraints in the preliminary design was that the vehicle had to fit under interstate bridges mm-hmm. while on a trailer, and it had to fit in the cargo bay of a C-17.
Okay.
So that, you know, a suborbital asset is basically a local tactical asset. It's something that you want to use in a particular place. And if you can't easily get it to that place, it's not very usable.
All right. Now, you mentioned before we started this conversation that you have about a year to run on your current contract. Are you going to, do you think, fulfill the objectives and get renewed?
Well, I hope so. Right now, there's two major wars on. So I have no idea.
Well, that could be good news or bad news.
You know, so far, everybody's been very pleased with how we're doing. So I don't see any reason why they wouldn't, other than availability of funds.
All right. Well, I'm going to refer our listeners to your website, and we'll link them there from the page where they found this interview. And you guys have been in business for 10 years. It sounds like the last three or four have been very exciting. And it sounds like you're in the most exciting part of your company development trajectory from here.
We're not bored.
Thanks very much for taking a few minutes out to tell us about TGV Rockets, and we will watch your progress with great interest.
Oh, you will.
You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. On the web, you'll find us at aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.